Well, I hope we're going to get right into the sermon here. Let's see what I can do to get it up. And there we go. Okay. I want to begin by talking about a little history, a little geography. You can read that. You don't have quite as smooth a screen to pick up some words sometimes. But I'm going to be talking about ancient Israel and some of the eras of ancient Israel, and looking at it from a particular perspective. But before I get into that, let's talk about a little bit of ancient history in general to begin with. Now, I've shown you a map here. Egypt's down here, of course. The Fertile Crescent. Everybody knows the Fertile Crescent from your history books, is up in that region. And basically, you go back and look at ancient history, and what you find is that the first societies that became more than families, small tribes of mostly family members, that sort of thing, the first evidence that we have of an organization of where peoples came together and began to work together rather than just being basically families and small little tribes occurred in several places, but one was in the Fertile Crescent area. And another one was in Egypt. And not too far behind that was the culture that developed over in Asia Minor and Greece, over in those areas. But I want to focus in on the Fertile Crescent and Egypt and the relationship there, because those two cultures or areas had a major influence on the development of expansion and growth of ancient Israel. Now, just to put a few dates on here to get it into perspective, the very earliest, and these dates are very approximate, don't take the dates too serious, but they kind of give you at least a general range of order of what we're talking about. But the area that the historians refer to as Sumer, developed. And Sumer refers to what was in this whole Fertile Crescent area right through there. Sumer was not really so much, at least initially, like a country or a nation, but in that general area, which was apparently a very rich area in terms of agriculture, in terms of weather and so forth, so it was easy to prosper there as compared to some other regions. And so people gravitated there. They were prosperous. They went from families to tribes to something akin to city-states, maybe town-states, then city-states. And then gradually, as commerce and so forth between these groups grew, they began to kind of organize into what we might call if not nations, it may be more like a confederacy of these city-states. And eventually they grew into some nations in that area. But we're talking about a period of around 1,500 years that this progressed. Now, as we get down to about 2000 B.C., some things begin happening. We don't have a lot of evidence. We have pottery. That's about the main thing we have back from that time. We have pottery, and there's inscriptions and stuff that give historians a hint of how things were then. And it seemed to be a relatively peaceful time as world history goes. But towards the, as we get down to around 2000, things begin to fall apart a little bit in that area. From up in this area, the Elamites and the Hittites begin moving in, and especially in the northern part of the area that is referred to as Sumer. and been gradually working it down towards the south. And by 2000, things were beginning to deteriorate in the northern part of Sumer. But about that time, from about 2000 to 1800, the southern part of Sumer, the historians refer to it as the Empire of Ur, his Ur right down here, that was considered, I guess, the capital, if you could call it that. But it was a short empire, an empire not in the sense of later empires, but it coalesced into a government that was basically defending itself against the expansion from the north of mainly the Hittites. And but it didn't last too long. So around 1800 B.C., the Hittites basically moved all the way south, and the kingdom of Ur was gone, was taken over. And it's kind of interesting from that perspective because, and again, these dates are very approximate, but it, many biblical historians believe that it was around this period of about 1800, in that general period, that God called Abraham out of Ur and sent him over basically traveling up and down until he came to the land of Canaan. And so it was in that general period. So you can't help but wonder. We can only speculate. We don't have enough historical information to know for sure what might have been going on. But it almost sounds like that maybe at that particular time, the civilization that had been known there for centuries in Sumer was beginning to collapse, or had collapsed and was being taken over by invading Hittites that had reached all the way down to Ur. And that may be, well be, that God said, we need to, I'm going to call Abraham, I need to get him out of there. And so God called Abraham, brought him down into the land of Canaan. Now, this upheaval with the Hittites didn't last too long. They reorganized into another kingdom, and the kingdom that they organized was the Babylonian Empire, which was fairly short, and this was the first Babylonian Empire, the Neo-Babylonian Empire, the later one. Came much later when basically Nebuchadnezzar and the fall of Israel. So we're talking about this was like 1,000 years earlier. This was during the period of time of Hammurabi. The thing that was mainly known of this Neo-Babylonian Empire was the laws of Hammurabi. So they gave an idea that there was an organized government and laws and so forth. But this was in the didn't last till about 1600, and then around 1600 to 1200 was the Hittite Empire that formed, and so and then we get down to around 1200. If these dates are approximately correct, that the biblical historians like to talk about around 1800. That Abraham was called around 400 years later, which would be around 1400, that Joseph went into Egypt, and then around 1000, 1100, somewhere in that range, the Exodus, so forth. So all these things kind of fit together a little bit with the geopolitical things that were happening, first in Sumer, and then later on in Egypt. So let's look at the history of ancient Egypt. You know, that organization began to form around the same time as it did in Sumer, up around 3000. Egypt we know a little bit more about, and some of the dates are a little more accurate. because the Egyptians recorded a lot, and they recorded in stone. And so things are written down. But, you know, early on, from about 3000 B.C. to around 2600 or so B.C., it's called the early dynastic period. It's kind of like Sumer. It's mostly city-states. There's no real central organizations, so much like Sumer. But they began merging into a kingdom. And so around 2600 to 2100, we have what's referred to as the Old Kingdom, which was considered one of the, if not the, golden era of Egypt. A lot of the well-known pharaohs ruled at that time. Some of the pyramids were built. The Great Pyramid was built during that time. But it lasts for around 500 years. But then, as most countries go, they get destabilized. Things happen, poor rulership, rebellions from internal, external, so forth. And so at that point, for roughly 100 years, from 2160 to around 2055, it was called the First Intermediate Period, which where things were kind of shaky. The divisions, it was a period of uncertainty, there was social unrest, there were some invasions, there were some insurrections, and then again a strong leader emerged, and we have from about 2055 to 1650, the Middle Kingdom. And this was considered a second golden era of Egypt, particularly in the area of the arts and culture. And so we see it was probably during the middle of this Middle Kingdom that God called Abraham, and he was came down into the area of Canaan, and so was familiar with Egypt and Egypt's culture at that time. Now, again, that era lasted for maybe 400 years. And then we come down to a second intermediate period in which there was a lot of things going on that, again, insurrections, invasions, unrest internally, all these kinds of things. So this is referred to as the second internal period. And you can see where if Abraham did indeed leave Ur around the 1800s, then somewhere not too long after this period, then the Jews were, Israelites were beginning to expand in Egypt, in the land of Goshen, in that area. But then around 1500 to about 1000 B.C., the New Kingdom. And so this era suggests a period of time when the Exodus occurred. We know that by around 1000 B.C., we're fairly confident of some dates by that time that we were in the area of vicinity of King David, the United Kingdom, and so forth at that time. So we have these two cultures, one to the south of Canaan, one pretty much to the north, a little bit to the east, but these two cultures were the influences primarily in Egypt. Now, there's others. There's Greek Macedonian cultures, but they tended to have less effect during this period of time. So it was mainly these three cultures. The New Kingdom was historians call the Third Golden Age of Egypt. And so we have all these things going on, and towards the end of these big eras of these two eras, Sumer and Egypt, we have the Israelites rising up and becoming a nation enslaved in Egypt during that time. So let's look at that for a minute. Look at the dates, some of the dates that are Again, very approximate, a lot of debate among historians about some of these dates, but just to get kind of in context. And, I'm going to list some approximate eras of ancient Israel going back to Abraham. And so the first era would be from a family to a tribe to slaves in Egypt, right up to the Exodus, in other words. Probably in the vicinity of between 1800 and about 1400 B.C., somewhere in that range. Then the second era was after the conquest of the land of Canaan, the period of the judges. And that was from about 1400 to about 1100. Again, very rough dates here. And you might call that era the Confederacy. I always like to talk about the Confederacy here in the South. But that was more or less what was going on at that time. The tribes were pretty well established when the Exodus occurred. They moved into Canaan. Each tribe was assigned a certain area, and the size of that area depended on the size of the tribes and so forth. And there was no central government. The priesthood basically was a government, but it was more of a, in terms of religion, and really limited in terms of what we generally think of as a government. So it was more of a confederacy. Everybody kind of had the same religion. They were reasonably at peace with each other. Although sometimes they got in fights and had arguments. But each tribe had a fair amount of independence, you might say. And there was no central ruling authority other than what associated with religion rather than anything else associated with government. And so we could call that the period of the Confederacy. And then the third period was the United Kingdom, which was a fairly short period, the time of the kings, Saul, David, and Solomon. That didn't last too long. And then we had the divided kingdom. That didn't last too long either. The northern 10 tribes of Israel, the southern tribe primarily of Judah and Levi, but some people from some of the other tribes, particularly Benjamin. So we had the dividing kingdom. And then in 721 is when northern Israel, the 10 tribes, were taken into captivity, and that ended that kingdom. And that left the nation of Judah, which lasted for another roughly 150 years before it was captured by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. And that destroyed the nation, basically. It took away everybody, pretty much. Didn't leave much of anybody there. And then we might look at from about the fall of Judah to the time of Christ. We can date it, say, to the birth of Christ around 4 B.C. There was the remnant. The remnant that was in captivity 70 years later, some of that remnant came back. Some stayed in Babylon. Eventually, it grew up, came under Roman rule, and so forth. But it was still just a remnant, mainly of Jews, that had worked their way back into the land of Canaan. So we have these eras. And what I want to do, and the reason I'm taking some time to kind of outline these eras here and initially, and the relationship between where Abraham came from, where the children of Israel came out of Egypt as they grew into a nation and so forth, that it all kind of ties together in many ways. But one way that things are tied together, and this is what I'm going to focus at on this sermon, and I'll give several more on this, and that is the history of the prophets. How does the role of prophets enter into the whole history of ancient Israel. Now, I'm not talking so much about the prophecies themselves, although certainly what the prophets say is of major importance. But we find that there's sometimes there's a lot of prophets, sometimes there are practically no prophets. What's this deal with the prophets down through the history of Israel? You know, God used the prophets to guide his chosen people. He's recorded some of this information about the prophets, who they were, what they were prophesying about. But at the same time, he doesn't mention all of them. The Bible gives some hints that, yeah, there were some other prophets. There are other written books of prophets that we have no knowledge of. They were not saved. They were lost over the period of time. And we know very little about some of those. But, you know, so what I want to focus on is not so much what they prophesize, but why they were prophesying, what they prophesized when they did. You know, that's the sort of thing that I want to look at. It's clear that there are many more prophets that are mentioned in the Bible, but I want to basically go through the ones that were mentioned as prophets and talk about them. And so if you want a title for the sermon, what is the significance of the ancient prophets today? You know, what does it mean to us? Obviously, we know some of these prophets by name. Some we know a lot about. Some we know a little about. Some we don't know much more than their name. And then there's some unknown prophets that their names are not even mentioned, but they are mentioned as unknown prophets. And then there's some that are not mentioned, that all history has been lost of some of these prophets, and so we know nothing about them at all. And so I want to start looking at that and go back to the very beginning of Israel, which was Abraham. He was not only the founding father, you might say, of the nation of Israel, but he was Israel's first prophet in that sense, as the founding father. Of course, it wasn't in Israel then, but it all sprang from him. So let's start with Abraham. Now, how do we know that Abraham was a prophet? Because the Bible tells us he was a prophet. I'm going to turn to Genesis 20 and verse 7, and the context here was that he was in the Abraham and Sarah were traveling in the Abimelech's kingdom, and you know the story there. Abraham told Abimelech that Sarah was his sister. Actually, she was his half sister, and Abimelech took her into his harem, and that didn't work out so well for Abimelech because God didn't like that and appeared to him in a dream. And what God told him in Genesis 27, "Now therefore restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet. And he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, and you and all of yours." Pretty strong words. So that got Abimelech's attention. And needless to say, he wasn't too happy with Abraham. You read the whole story there. Why'd you do this to me? You know, basically, why'd you lie to me and get me in trouble with God and this sort of thing? But it's interesting, but how do we know about this? How did this end up in the Bible? You know, I think sometimes we tend to think in terms of, you know, if it says it in the Bible, that's true. If it doesn't say it in the Bible, it must not have happened, you know. But a lot of things happen that weren't written down in the Bible. Do you not suppose that that Abraham told the stories of his experiences with God to Isaac, to Jacob, and passed it on down the line in terms of stories? Perhaps in terms of writing things down that were written. Some of these things might have been revealed by later revelations from God to some of the individuals and future prophets that that God related to them, but you know, people talk, and especially about things like that. Man, what happened? God said, "Come out of a pretty nice little kingdom up there," and all of a sudden, I'm down here in Canaan and in Egypt and here and in there, and I almost lost a wife, and so you know, these kind of things. But not things you just kind of say, that's not my life's not very interesting. I don't need to even tell my kids about that, you know. So these things were passed down in various ways. We don't know all the ways, but there was obviously a lot going on in these lives. And then we come to Abraham's son Isaac, and it's not specifically mentioned that Isaac was a prophet, but we do have a recording of one of his prophecies in Genesis 27, verses 27 to 29. He was blessing, he was near death and was blessing his two sons, Jacob and Esau. Jacob was the schemer, you know the story again. He pretended to be Esau. He got Esau's blessing in verse 27 of Genesis 27. And he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his clothing and blessed him and said, "Surely this is the smell of my son. Is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore may God give you the dew of the heavens, the fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you." So this was a prophecy. It was a blessing, but it was also a prophecy of what was going to happen. One son was going to become a people, and our peoples, and the descendants of the other son would be bowing down to the descendants of of Jacob in this case. And so certainly that was a prophecy. We don't learn much more about prophecies from between Abraham and Isaac, except that certainly the basic understanding of the promises of God, that their descendants would become as the sand in the sea, as God told Jacob, for example. Surely those things were passed down. And then we come to Jacob, and we know Jacob was a prophet. In Genesis 49, verse 1, I'll just look at a little bit of this. And then this is Jacob's near Jacob's death. And Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." And so again, so he prophesied and gave specific prophecies to each of his sons. And you look at these prophecies and you think, well, you know, they were kind of vague. Some of these things we could see fulfilled, but, you know, for example, I won't show that scripture, but in verse 13, do we really care that Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea, and he shall have a haven for ships, and his border shall adjoin Sidon? Well, I guess that's nice to know, but did it really have anything, does that have anything to do with anything now? Well, maybe not, but, you know, it says in the last days, in the days during the time of Israel, Zebulun wasn't that near Sidon. it was in the northern part of Israel, but it was kind of inland and so forth. And so, you know, maybe there's some future prophecy that's going to tie into that. But anyway, we have this list of prophecies about all the sons, and over the years, different people have tried to tie down. Well, where did the descendants of Reuben go? Where did the descendants of Gad go, and so forth, and try to decipher all this? And God will let us know in time just exactly what all happened, but kind of hard for us to figure it all out. We have some hints about some that are stronger than others, but this was part of Jacob was a prophet, and if we and what I'm going to do is I'm going to start giving you a list here of some points about what we can learn from the prophets and their role in history. And this is the first point I want to emphasize here, and that is that life is not random. There's a plan, and you can be a part of that plan. Now, we have all this history of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their travels, and what happened, and how Joseph ended up in Egypt, and all these kind of things that were going on. But it was all part of a plan. God works things out that way, you know. There are random things in life, but when God calls you, life suddenly becomes much less random. There is a plan. You have to recognize how you can be a part of that plan. You know, God's going to show you. He's going to reveal it. He's going to let you know how you fit into that plan. But that's one of the reasons we have all this recorded in the Bible, so we can begin to understand that this is knowledge that's being passed on to us. God didn't record the things in the Bible that was just related to that time or that individual so much as he did record things that we can learn lessons from on down through the ages. So, but let's jump on to Joseph. Now, certainly Joseph was a prophet, and we know this story of Joseph, so I'm not going to spend much time going through that, but just mention a few things without turning to the scriptures, that he dreamed he would rule his brothers. That was in Genesis 37, 5 through 8. That didn't go over well with his brothers. So they got rid of him, basically, sold him off as a slave. And so in Genesis 41, he began interpreting dreams, prophesying about what would happen to the people in prison that he had met there. The last prophecy of Joseph was given in Genesis 50, verse 24. And Joseph said to his brethren, "I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." So this was a pretty big prophecy that Joseph left the family with. That, you're going to go back to Canaan because that's what God promised to Abraham. And so that was a pretty big prophecy. But why did they have to go through all this trouble? They were already in Canaan. Why spend all this time in Egypt, go through all these trials and tribulations and so forth? You know, why did God do it that way? You know, that's sometimes we see this unfold and we start asking these kind of questions. Why work it out in this fashion? It didn't seem to make a lot of sense in some ways. If God's going to establish a kingdom, they were already in Canaan, let's build the kingdom and get going here. You know, why sojourn in Egypt for hundreds of years? Well, let's jump over to Genesis 50, verses 18 through 20. You know, near the end of, we're going back in time a little bit to when Joseph finally came back together and resolved the issues with his brothers. In verse 18 of Genesis 50, "Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' And Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about, as it is this day, to save many people alive.'" Now, did it have to happen that way? You know, we see, this is the way it did happen. We can ask, well, why did it happen this way? What were the problems that led to some of these things? Was this just a bunch of really good people that God just kicked around? No, there was an arrogant young brother who he didn't know how to deal with things with his brothers. And he went on to say, hey, one day you're going to worship me. I'm going to rule over you. And then there were these brothers who didn't take much to that whole idea. And obviously, as you read the whole history of the sons of Jacob, the descendants there, they weren't very good people. And, you know, God was not only working out a plan, he was teaching a people. And they had to learn some lessons. So you can't help but wonder that, God said, okay, well, if this is the way we need to do it, my plan's going to work. But we'll work it out so you learn too. And so Joseph learned his lessons. The brothers learned his lessons. You might also say that maybe it wasn't so bad that they spent some time in Egypt, because the rest of the world was, a lot of stuff was going on. You know, the Hittites and the Syrians and so forth were coming along. Canaan was caught in the middle of that. Maybe Canaan wasn't that great a place to raise a country. Whereas in Egypt, they were kind of protected because Egypt was relatively strong during that period of time. So there are a lot of things that could have been going on there. But the point was that some people had to learn the lessons. And God will teach you the lessons, and then he'll work out his plan along the way. But we see God working out his plan within the framework of the civilizations and what's going on at that time. He intervenes when he needs to. But, you know, we can't assume that everything is working out this way because, God's in charge and he wants it that way for no reason except he wants it that way. You know, so another couple of points here that I want to bring out, and that is no matter the path you take, no matter the trials that beset you, God will work it out if you are faithful. Now, certainly, there was a level of faith shown throughout those first generations of our founding fathers, you might say. Faith was a bedrock. Not that they didn't make mistakes, not that they didn't have to learn things, but God is going to work it out as long as you remain faithful. And that was the key. But there's a big but here. Don't assume that when you mess up, it's just God working out his plan. Okay? You mess up. But I think sometimes we think, God's working out his plan. Yeah, I've got this trial, I've got this, but God's going to work it out. I'll just kind of cruise along here and not look at yourself and see and recognize that you messed up and repent and change. Certainly, just talking about Joseph, certainly his attitude changed. A little prison time did wonders for his attitude, humbled him. But sometimes we get in this mentality that instead of really examining ourselves and saying, what's our role, what's my role in where I am and the problems I'm having, saying, just kind of dismiss it and saying, well, God will work it out. Something will happen. And not really look at yourself. You know, so those have to go hand in hand. And so we got this period then of our forefathers. And then they end up in Egypt. And then hundreds of years go by. And we have all this information about those hundreds of years recorded by prophets? No. All we know is that hundreds of years went by. Where were the prophets? From the time of Joseph's death to the time of Moses, what do we know? Well, the new Pharaoh came along, the Egyptians enslaved the tribes of what would become Israel. And they were slaves for hundreds of years. Probably helped build a lot of the great monuments that arose up Egypt during that period of time. But we have no information there. In terms of prophets, it was a pretty much a dead period until another prophet finally shows up. Two of them, they're kind of hand in hand. The Bible in Exodus 7 and verse 1 points out specifically that Aaron's was a prophet. So the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet." So here Aaron's referred to as a prophet, and then later as the priesthood was established under Aaron's and his descendants, it was kind of implied that the priests would have some times be prophets. That wasn't the designation. The priesthood was not a prophethood. It was a priesthood, but that did not mean that some of these priests were not prophets during certain times. And so really only Aaron and Moses were the only prophets of any significance during this whole period of time of the Exodus that occurred. Now we see some instances where some others thought they should be prophets. They thought, "Hey, why are you in charge here? Why are you the one that's doing all these things? We're pretty good too. We came from the same forefathers as you did." But it was Moses that was the prophet during that period of time of the Exodus. Deuteronomy 34 verses 10 through 12. And this is kind of summing up things at the end of Moses' life. "But since then, there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, in all the signs and the wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, before Pharaoh, before all his servants, and in all his land, and by all that mighty power, and all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel." Now, of course, this was obviously added later. We don't know exactly when this was added to the Bible. But Moses wasn't writing this, but because it's sometime later. And still, no prophet had shown up greater than Moses. And you could probably argue that until the time of Jesus Christ, Moses might be considered the greatest prophet. Certainly, there were some other great prophets that are recorded in the Bible. But how many of those prophets talked to God face to face? You know, so Moses is, you might say, Moses brought prophecy into the mainstream of religion. That was one of the things he did. Let's look at Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 through 19. "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren." So here Moses is making a prophecy of another prophet to come. "That God will raise up a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren. Him you shall hear according to all you desired of the Lord, your God in Horeb, in the day of the assembly, saying, 'Let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, nor let me see this great fire anymore, lest I die.' And the Lord said to me, 'What they have spoken is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brethren, and will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall be that whoever will not hear my words, which he speaks in my name, I will require it of him.'" Now, a couple of points here of what Moses is telling the people. You know, it's a warning. If you don't heed that prophet when he shows up, watch out. You're going to be in trouble if you don't heed that prophet when he comes. So it's a warning. I'm not going to continue reading here, but he goes on to say that, you know, test the prophets. Test them. Find out if their predictions come to pass. And, of course, there's this duality of prophecies that occur throughout the Old Testament. They had a role in the short-term history, but often a duality in long-term history. We'll talk some more about that another time. How do you distinguish which is which, and when it is actually dual and when it might not be actually dual. But anyway, that's what God is, Moses was saying here, prophesying that there was going to be another prophet like him, clearly referring to Jesus Christ. And if we look over in Acts 3 and verse 22 through 25, Peter talks about this. Peter is speaking, "For Moses truly said to the fathers, 'The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear in all things, whatever he says to you, and it shall be that every soul who will not hear that prophet shall be utterly destroyed from among the people.' Yes, and all the prophets from Samuel and those who follow, as many as have spoken, have also foretold these days. You are the sons of the prophets and of the covenant, which God made with our fathers, saying to Abraham, 'And in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" So here Peter's referring back. Obviously, this was all explained to the apostles by Christ as to how this all fit together. So Moses was doing some long-range prophesying, but the Israelites in general, the Jews in particular at this time, didn't get it. You know, you can kind of see how they didn't get it. The Jews sent priests, Levites, to question John the Baptist. In John 1, verses 20 and 21, they had asked him, "Who are you?" That was the question. And he confessed and did not deny, but confessed, "I am not the Christ." And this Greek word for Christ here, and used throughout the New Testament, is the Messiah. So I'm not the Messiah. And they asked him, "What then? Are you Elijah?" Now, obviously, when they asked him if he was Elijah, they were thinking of Malachi 4 or 5, that prophecy from Malachi, that one appearing like Elijah would come. And he said, "I'm not," meaning he was not the resurrected Elijah, because their thinking was that Elijah was going to actually be resurrected from the dead and come back. They asked, "Are you the prophet?" And he answered, "No." Okay, so they basically were confused about three things. They wanted to know if John the Baptist was the Messiah, if he was a resurrected Elijah, or if he was the prophet. The prophet. Obviously referring back to Moses' prophecy at that time. Now, then John, in the next few verses, which I won't show here, he goes on to quote Isaiah 40 passage about a voice crying in the wilderness and so forth. I want to go to another scripture here in John 6 and verses 14 and 15. And this was after the feeding of the 5,000. After the feeding of the 5,000, then this happened. "Then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, 'This is truly the prophet who is coming to the world.' Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force and make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself." Okay, so we have the Messiah, the prophet, Elijah. And they couldn't figure out exactly what was going on here. Let's look over at John 7, verses 37 through 41. On the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." But this he spoke concerning the Spirit, which those believing in him would receive, for the Holy Spirit was not yet given, because Jesus was not yet glorified. Therefore, many from the crowd, when they heard this saying, said, "Truly, this is the prophet." Others said, no, this is the Messiah. But some said, will Christ ever come out of Galilee? Will the Messiah ever come out of Galilee? All right, so we see, you see what the problem was. These great prophecies going back to Moses is that there's going to be a Messiah, there's going to be a prophet, and Elijah's going to show up in some form. You know, they were thinking in terms of a resurrected Elijah. John the Baptist was, you know, acting in the way that Elijah did and was fulfilling that prophecy. We won't turn to those scriptures, but as it was pointed out in, by Christ, that he fulfilled that scripture when he came preaching that Christ was about to arrive in person. But what were they missing? What were they missing? You know, setting aside Elijah, that was. But why were they looking for two different people? A Messiah and the prophet. What was going on here? Now, when they said after the feeding of the 5,000 and that miracle, they wanted to make, you know, they thought he's the prophet. Let's make him king. And so that suggests the mentality was that they were looking for the prophet to come, become king, and throw off the Romans and restore Israel as a nation like Moses restored Israel. And that basically what Moses did. He created a nation of Israel from a bunch of slaves. The Jews viewed themselves enslaved by Rome. The prophet would come, create a nation that's not enslaved anymore. You can see where they're going there. But what about the Messiah? Well, they knew of the scriptures that talked about a Messiah coming at a time when there would be peace and everything would be, you know, they knew there was a Messiah coming. They knew there was a prophet coming, the prophet. They didn't have any concept that they were one and the same person, and he, not they, he was going to appear twice, once as a human, once as the Son of God returning to rule the earth. They never got that connection. You know, Moses was telling them way back then, and for that reason, you know, we needed to know that. You know, and I say, when I say we and us, I'm basically talking about everybody after the time of the prophecy was given. You know, not we needed to know it now. The Jews needed to know it back in the first century. This information needed to be known. It was recorded and explained down through the age. So the context is, when you need to know it, God explains it. But when it was explained to them by Jesus Christ, they didn't get it. They didn't see it. Look at Deuteronomy 29 and verses, I'm going to begin reading here in verses 2-4. But 28 was the blessings and cursings chapter. And we're at the end of Moses' life here. Now Moses called all Israel and said to them, you have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to his servants and to all his land, the great trials which your eyes have seen, the signs, the great wonders. Yet the Lord has not given you a heart to perceive and eyes to see and ears to hear to this very day. They just didn't get it. You know, so, see, up to this point, you might say they were still under the curse in the wilderness, of the 40 years in the wilderness. You know, the 40 years were over. They were getting ready to move into the promised land. It's a new generation. But they were still under that curse until they had a chance to accept the covenant. Deuteronomy 29, verses 5-9. And I've led you for 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out on you, and your sandals have not worn out on your feet. And you have not eaten bread, nor have drunk wine or similar drink, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. You suppose they, 40 years, you know, these were kids. They grew up. They were now mature men and women in their 40s, 50s, in that age group, the youngest, you know, that from the time of the Exodus. You think they noticed? You know, I've been wearing these same shoes for 40 years. Man, this is a 40-year-old suit, and it is fine. You know, it's like I said, haven't you noticed what's going on here? All these things that have happened, even your clothes have not worn out for 40 years. Any of you have any 40-year-old clothing that you're still wearing? Any of you have any 40-year-old clothing that would remotely fit? Yeah, things change, don't they? I mean, I felt pretty good. I got back 10 or 12 years ago, I got this T-shirt when I was skiing in Canada, and had a neat little thing about a bear chasing a wolf who was chasing a rabbit who was so forth, and eventually chasing a skier. But it's a neat little thing across there, and I like that. But that thing's worn out. It's got holes all in. I can't wear it anymore. It's so worn out. So it lasted 13 years or 12 years or something like that, and that's about my record for anything that I've wear. But they didn't notice. It almost seems that they didn't pay any attention to these kids. Oh, that's just the way things are. They don't wear out. It's kind of like their mentality was. And so he pointed that out to them. And continue on here. And when you came to this place, Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against you, against us into battle, and we conquered them. We took their name, took their land, and gave it as an inheritance to the Reubenites, to the Gadites, and to half the tribe of Manasseh. Therefore, keep the word of this covenant and do them, that you may prosper in all that you do. So see, this is a renewing of the covenant. So you've got to agree to the same thing the ancient Israelites did. And then continuing on in verse 10, all of you stand today before the Lord your God, your leaders, your tribes, your elders, and your officers, all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, also the stranger who is in your camp, from the one who cuts your wood to the one who draws your water, that you may enter into the covenant with the Lord your God and into his oath, which the Lord your God makes with you today. But that he may establish you today as a people for himself, and that he may be God to you, just as he has spoken to you, and just as he has sworn to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I make this covenant and this oath, not with you alone, but also with him who stands here with us today before the Lord our God, as well as with him who is not here with us today. So I'm saying this covenant is a perpetual covenant. And so he's renewing it here. And then he talks about what failure is going to mean if you don't keep it. You know, and if you read chapter 30, you know, follow this up with chapter 30. Chapter 30 is gruesome. It talks about what happens or what is going to happen if you don't keep the covenant. And it is gruesome. It talks about things like things will get so bad, you'll resort to cannibalism. And that's pretty gruesome. And that's what takes place in a good part of chapter 30. But I'm not going to go through all of that, but I want to just go to the first few verses here, Deuteronomy 30 and verses 1 through 3. Now it shall come to pass, when all these things have come upon you, the blessings, the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God drives you, and you return to the Lord your God and obey his voice according to all that I command you today, and you and your children with all your heart and with all your soul, that the Lord your God will bring you back from captivity and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where the Lord your God has scattered you. And you see what Moses is prophesying. He's saying, you will fail. So you're going to fail. But take heart. Even though you say you're going to obey the covenant, even though you're taking a vow to serve God, you will fail. But all is not lost. God is going to bring back his people eventually. Now, he wasn't saying that those living then would fail necessarily. Many did. But he was saying, down through the ages, it's going to be a failure. But gave the promise of the millennium. And then in Deuteronomy 30, verse 11, for this commandment which I command you today is not too mysterious for you, nor is it far off. He said, we're not talking about rocket science here. It's not that complicated. And then he rehearses the history a little bit of the Exodus and back to Abraham. And then in verse 19, he says, I call heaven and earth as witness today against you that I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life that both you and your descendants may live. Now, this statement is very telling, because would it be fair for God to say, serve me, you'll live, choose life, you'll live, don't choose to serve me, you're going to die, if they were incapable of doing that? Would that be fair? What God is saying is you do have a choice. Now, as a nation, Moses is telling them, it's not going to work. You're going to fail. But as individuals, some did not fail. Remember when Elijah was up on the mountain, said he was the only one left? God said, nope, got 7,000 you don't even know about. Now, so individually, you can succeed. As a nation, there's not enough individuals to make it work. And so God's saying, I'm just warning you in advance. So brings me to the fourth point here. We are capable of making the right choices even before baptism. These people weren't baptized. They were not baptized. God was working with them like he works with each of us before we're baptized. Before you were baptized, didn't you start making some right decisions? Didn't you change? Before baptism, as God began to call, yeah, you begin to make some right decision. God was working with you. You know, so we're capable of making right decisions. This is another thing we can learn from the prophets. We're capable of making right decisions, even before baptism. But are we going to do it? And then Deuteronomy 31, verse 25. So it was when Moses had completed writing the works of this law in a book, when they were finished, that Moses commanded the Levites who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, take this book of the law, put it beside the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there as a witness against you. And he said, notice, he doesn't say, take it, put it by the covenant. So now, whenever you need to kind of check up, remind yourself, go back and look at it, and so forth. No, it's a witness against you. As a nation, you're going to fail. You're simply going to. I'm writing it down. I'm writing it in stone. I guess you wrote it in stone. But, you know, he said, I'm writing it down, and it's going to be there in your face constantly that these prophecies are there. You know, so he's giving them every chance not to fail. But most did. So he said, I'm going to use this as a witness against you, for I know your rebellion and your stiff neck. Now he's talking to these people. They're getting ready to go in the promised land. Everything is happy. We're finally through with this wilderness business. And he says, you are rebellious and you have a stiff neck. If today, while I'm yet alive with you, you have been rebellious against the Lord, then how much more after my death? Strong words. Gather to me all the elders of your tribes, your officers, that I may speak these words in their hearing and call heaven and earth to witness against them. So he's really laying it out, saying, look, this is what's going to happen. I'm warning you now. Learn from it. And so in verse 29 of Deuteronomy 31, for I know that after my death you will become utterly corrupt. You're going to become corrupt. Now you're speaking to the nation, not every individual. And turn aside from the way which I have commanded you, and evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger through the work of your hands. Strong words indeed. Which brings me to the fifth point here. Moses' prophecies are proofs, not only of the Bible, but that God means what he says. When God gives a prophecy, he means it. Now, he also says that prophecies can fail. If we change, prophecies can fail. So individually, these prophecies fail because some individuals did stay with God, did stay true with God, and died in the faith down through the ages. But the nation didn't. The nation couldn't do it as a whole. So we have this list. I'm starting a list here today. That life is not random. There is a plan, and you can be a part of the plan. That no matter the path you take, no matter the trials that you beset you, God will work it out if you're faithful. But don't assume that when you mess up, it's just God working out his plan. No, it's you messing up. Yeah, God's going to work out his plan. But don't you mess up. And then we are capable of making the right choices even before baptism. We're capable. God lays it out. He's working with us. And then the fifth point, Moses' prophecies are proofs not only of the Bible, but that God means what he said. What I've done is I've basically covered that first era from Abraham to the Exodus, getting to the point of ready to enter Canaan. And we haven't had that many prophets yet. But so the next time I want to look at the next 400 years or so, and what, in terms of the prophets and what the prophets did and what the prophets meant at these different eras as we go through further into the history of ancient Israel.